These days, I can do anything from my phone. Book a vacation, order a meal from a five-star restaurant, buy and trade stocks. But maybe the most amazing thing I can do is make my dirty laundry disappear and then reappear perfectly washed and folded. I have Rinse to thank for that. I just schedule a pickup in the Rinse app or at Rinse.com. A Rinse valet comes to get my clothes, and before I know it, they're back, crisply folded and ready to wear. They even do dry cleaning, which is returned hanging in a nice Rinse garment bag. And with Rinse, my satisfaction is guaranteed. If for any reason I'm not happy, they'll re-clean my clothes for free. Best of all, Rinse saves me tons of time each week. That's time I get to do something I love versus something I have to do. So if you want to save loads of time by not doing loads of laundry, remember, there's an app for that. Rinse. Sign up now and get $20 off your first order at Rinse.com. That's Rinse.com.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Dede Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. The term The Nation, as it refers to the country rather than the magazine, has a surprisingly recent history in American political rhetoric. Until the Civil War, politicians more commonly used the Union or the Republic. That changed with Abraham Lincoln, who referenced the nation five times in his 1863 Gettysburg Address. 2 years later, in July 1865, the first issue of our magazine was published. What nationhood would look like and what it would mean to a group of once warring states were two fundamental questions the magazine's founders had to address. The Confederacy had been defeated. Lincoln had been murdered. And of course, a new war was already underway. As writer Richard Kreitner notes, a fierce fight over whether the nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal would indeed see a new birth of freedom had begun. Ever since then, the writers and editors of The Nation magazine have tried to see that struggle through on our pages. For our 160th anniversary issue, we called on 50 of our country's best writers and artists to depict the current national landscape, what's being gutted, steamrolled, and eviscerated, and what some of us are doing to keep the national project afloat. Joining us today is the nation's own contributing writer, Richard Kreitner, who helped take on the monumental task of putting this issue together. Richard is also the author of the recent book, Fear No Pharaoh, American Jews, the Civil War, and the Fight to End Slavery. Richard, welcome to the Nation Podcast.
Thank you, Don. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. And I also want to say what a stroke of enormous good luck it was for us that you had finished your labors on your book in time to be able to come back briefly to the magazine to do this.
Yeah, it all worked out very nicely. I also want to note, I've been associated with the magazine for, I think, 13 years now in a bunch of different capacities. I think this is my first time on a Nation podcast.
Oh, well, that's, we'll have to remedy that because you're a good guy on radio, and this would be a good place to plug your own podcast, so go ahead.
Oh, great. Yeah, Think Back, everybody. Check out my podcast, Think Back, where I interview American historians, Aziz Rana, Greg Grandin, a lot of your favorites. Check it out.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I can vouch for it as a great listen. So what some of our listeners may not know is that this is not your or my first rodeo together, that when The Nation put out its 150th anniversary issue 10 years ago, we basically looked at the magazine's history and the history of the country. And this time we decided, instead of looking backwards, to look outwards. But we still found a way to do it that resonates with the magazine's history. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, as you know, Don, as the historian of The Nation, you know, the author of the official biography, it was originally called The New York Nation, placing it directly in Manhattan. But it was always looking outward towards the rest of the country, more or less successfully and thoroughly at different times. I think you've said that it's always been kind of a struggle on the part of the Manhattan-based editorial staff to understand the rest of the country. So here, I think the idea was to kind of get people on the ground in each of these places, major writers, poets, cartoonists in some cases, and get them to give us the depiction of life on the ground in each of the states in this year of our Lord 2025.
But it's also true that the magazine has done a 50-state, as it were, panorama before, twice.
Right. First in the 1920s, when major writers like H.L. Mencken wrote for Maryland, Sherwood Anderson for Ohio, Willa Cather for Nebraska, Edmund Wilson for New Jersey, and other major writers wrote very long essays for each of these states that were published not in one single issue. It would have been impossible, but over the course of about 3 years, from 1922 to 1925, giving a kind of description and depiction of the what was left of kind of the local texture that modernity, such as it was at that moment, had not yet completely steamrolled. And the magazine was interested. You know, for the most part, they wanted things to be more kind of concentrated. They were opposed to, you know, certain kind of local institutions such as Jim Crow segregation, but for the most part was interested in a kind of consolidation of national life. But they wanted to see what did that miss? What did that kind of leave out, this flattening of local diversities and textures and whatnot?
And when they did that, they called it These United States. And then in the 1970s, John Leonard did this again?
In the 2000s,
okay.
Yeah, and while working on this, actually, I realized that they didn't all run in the magazine. They ran a few of them, but it was mostly a book anthology that he edited. So all of them can be found in an anthology that the Once Nation Books put out in the 2000s. And some of those ran in the magazine, like, I forget some of the examples, Molly Ivins on Texas, for one thing. And both of those, actually, the 20s version and the 2000s version edited by John Leonard, are in book anthologies that can be purchased that are really, you know, a fascinating read. And the 20s one has been studied by literary scholars for years as an important document in the early kind of rebirth of American regionalism that ends up kind of crescendoing in the 30s under the New Deal.
Right.
Which is an interesting kind of interplay between a national culture and a, you know, more local regionalist variation.
Well, I was thinking about that because I was thinking about the way in which the nation assembling these writers was a kind of foreshadowing of what the Federal Writers Project would do 10 years later, that it would, you know, it would go to each state and it would try and find enough writers, you know, it would find who's the prominent writer from that state, can we get them to write for the state guide? And in many cases, they could because there was no work and the writers were all broke. Happily for writers today, we didn't have that lure. On the other hand, we got some surprising names to write for this issue who are not usually in the nation. So check it out and you may be astonished at the variety of contributors. But we also wanted to mark the way in which our country feels very different today than it did in the 2000s, let alone in the 1920s. So we're not calling it These United States, we're calling it These Disunited States. And I have to say that in terms of the theme of disunion, that's something you've thought about a lot, so.
Yeah, certainly. Well, you know, my book, Break It Up, which came out in 2020, which was a history of the idea of secession and division and disunion in American history, you know, I first started working on that project actually when you and I were working together on the 2015 150th anniversary issue. And I was reading deeply into the history of the Civil War and the context of the abolitionist movement that the nation came out of. You know, it was founded basically, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it inherited the subscription list of the Liberator.
Yes, it did.
Right? That's an incredible origin story for a magazine to still exist in 2025. But that kind of was leading me into reading more and more about the abolitionist movement. And I was fairly astonished to learn that before the war, they had been disunionists, you know, Garrison especially, calling for the North to secede from the country because they disapproved of slavery and actually thought that their tax dollars going to support, you know, the Massachusetts tax dollars going to support slavery was part of what was kind of bolstering it and keeping it alive, and they didn't want to have any part of that.
What?
That's something I'd never learned before.
That's a question. I didn't learn that either, but then when I studied the Civil War in Memphis, Tennessee, we called it the War Between the States, so there's a lot that I wasn't... there's a lot that was not vouchsafed unto us in the South when we were studying this history, but...
They actually like talking about that, though, because it shows that disunion was not their original idea.
Well, but that's kind of a question I want to ask you, which is, You know, there were plenty of abolitionists whose attitude to the United States was, don't let the door hit you on the way out. And so that's the mild version. In other words, there were abolitionists who wanted to secede, but there were also abolitionists who thought, okay, let them go. You know, we'll be a stronger country. And, you know, when you look at the electoral map today, you have to have at least some mixed feelings about the success of General Grant and Abraham Lincoln in holding the Union together. And I know that you had some of those mixed feelings in your book. I mean, I wonder, where is this thread of secession in American life? Does it just disappear and come back when times are really bad? Or is it a kind of ever-percolating stock pot on the stove that occasionally boils over?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. You know, I quote somebody in my book saying that the idea of secession is embedded in the very name of the country itself, the United States of America, which is the thing we're playing on, and they were playing on in the 20s. These United States implies a plurality. And the idea of calling your country the United States of America in 1776 is basically a claim not about something that is, but about something that they wanted to be, wanted it to become. But the very idea of something being united is the idea that it can be broken apart.
Well, and also, you know, as I'm sure, well, I mean, I know you know this because it's in your book, but our...
We should talk about the issue. No,
well, we will, but this is interesting, and, you know, we're allowed to do this on a podcast. It's one of the joys of podcasting. You know, that the Constitution replaced a document that was the founding organizing document of the country, and that was the Articles of Confederation, which is why the Confederacy called itself the Confederacy. They were like, well, we want to go back to the idea of a confederation. And, you know, what we find now, looking out at the country in 2025, is that there are varying degrees of attachment to the notion of a union. So talk a little bit about the variety of perspectives that we got from the writers you reached out to for this issue.
Yeah, I mean, well, some of them gave us, you know, a look at the politics of the state. So Luke Mayville in Idaho writing about school vouchers getting pushed through, you know, a heavily Republican legislature. We had a writer, Gabriel Furshong in Montana, talking about how the state party there had been totally overtaken by the Trumpist right and leaving, you know, more kind of Mitt Romney type conservatives in the lurch, but also not fully kind of owning up to the ways in which they had laid the groundwork for the takeover of the party and the real splitting of the country. Another, you know, favorite piece of mine is Sarah Jaffe writing for Louisiana, where she's problematizing this idea of red states and blue states, which we present on the page online as well, by showing each state's outline in red or blue with the percentage of what vote they got, you know, each party got in the election. She really problematizes this idea of red states and blue states, arguing that every state is divided in almost exactly the same way of blue cities and red countryside, you know, hinterland. And the only difference of what makes a technically blue state or red state is whether their cities are populous enough to overcome that overwhelming conservative lean of the hinterland. Then, you know, and I think she also touches on the point, if not maybe Lauren Groff does in Florida, the novelist, talking about how Republican-leaning states are the enemies of local control in preventing progressive cities from having any kind of say over what goes on in their jurisdictions. So there's a lot of pieces in there that really do kind of scramble this idea of red states and blue states. There's even, you know, in Wyoming, which I think is the most red-leaning state in the country based on the presidential vote, there's still something like 28 to 29% of its residents that voted for Kamala Harris in the presidential election. You know, not anywhere close to a majority, but also not at all negligible. You know, one thing that gives me pause about the idea of secession is that we are so intertwined. If I leave my street here in the Hudson Valley and I make a right, I've got a trans flag, you know, two doors down. If I make a left, I've got the Samuel Alito appeal to heaven flag, you know, the same distance. So how do you split that? You know, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, no, I think it would be messy. And I think, you know, I'm looking at page 36, just at random, as it were. And on page 36, you have Idaho and Illinois. And, you know, we think of Idaho, that's Luke Mayville's writing from there, as a deeply red state, which indeed it is, but it's 67%. So that's not even 70%. You know, right. Illinois, Chris Ware, the cartoonist, surprised me by sending in words rather than pictures, but they're really interesting words. And his take on Chicago is that it's a blue island, but the state went 54% Democratic. So, you know, it's a close run thing.
I didn't know it was 54%. That seems uncomfortably close to 50.
Yeah, well, you know, as we've written many times and reported in some detail and analyzed, perhaps some listeners may feel to death, Kamala Harris underperformed in the last election.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that.
There are states which shouldn't have been so close that were quite close.
Yeah, but I'm glad you mentioned the Blue Island piece because, you know, in Illinois, in addition to tracking national secession movements before my book came out and after, you know, movements by Texas to leave the United States, I'm also tracking, you know, state secession movements. So movements to take some counties from eastern Oregon and attach them to Idaho. There's been various ballot initiatives in some other places. And Illinois is one of those where downstate Illinois wants to secede and separate itself from Chicago because they're tired of the metropolis's dominance of state politics, which is the opposite situation that you wrote about for New York, which is your idea that New York City should secede from New York State and form its own state, which itself has got a whole very interesting lineage to it, going back to debates over ratification of the Constitution. So do you want to transition there for a sec to
No, I mean, I was, you know, to be honest, I was inspired by two things writing about New York. I mean, one is the current mayoral race and the many great ideas I've heard from lots of the progressives who are in the race. And, you know, as faithful listeners will know, we've endorsed Zoran Mamdani number one and Brad Lander as number two in the ranked choice votings. But they have great ideas, but they're also dependent on the legislature because New York does not have home rule. In other words, if you want to do anything ambitious with New York's budget, you have to get permission from the governor and the legislature. And that's exactly what, for example, Andrew Cuomo refused to give Bill de Blasio when he wanted to secure the funding for his pre-K, pre-kindergarten program by having a special tax on millionaires. And Cuomo said no. So the program got through and it's still there, but it's part of the general budget, which means that any governor who doesn't like it can cut it in the same way that the Trump is cutting programs he doesn't like from the federal budget. But with much more constitutional sanction, a New York governor can cut this program from New York City schools if they want to. And, you know, it seems to me as a New York City resident of, you know, many years standing that it's not okay to have the Albany tail wag the New York City dog. New York City is the main source of funding for the New York State budget. It is, you know, almost as populous as the rest of the state put together, and that we should stop letting Albany dictate to us. So one source of inspiration was the realization that all of these good ideas are going to be frustrated if the governor wants to frustrate them. The second was, in a way, and you'll pardon my using a technical term here, koshering the idea of secession in your secession book, and then remembering that Jimmy Breslin and Norman Mailer had run for mayor and controller, or mayor and city council president. I don't think anybody ever thought Breslin would be controller. They had run as a ticket in 1969 on the 51st state on a secession platform. And I think they're ahead of their time, and I think that New York City should secede. And that's what I say in my contribution to this 50-state issue, because, you know, we gave our writers fairly wide latitude, and I thought that as this is my last full issue as editor of The Nation, I should use the latitude to say what I actually think. And what I actually think is that New York City should detach itself from New York State and allow the city to flourish as a city-state in the same category as Singapore and other really prosperous and flourishing city-states, from Athens to Singapore.
I love it. And, you know, I mentioned there's a long history to the idea, going back to the ratification of the Constitution, the Federalists wanted to ratify the Constitution. The upstate Anti-Federalists did not. And they threatened that Manhattan, which was then New York City, would secede from the state in order to ratify the Constitution, and everybody upstate would be completely screwed. It was effectively blackmail that got the Constitution across the finish line, where Alexander Hamilton's Federalist op-eds did not do the trick. And then during the Civil War, also the mayor, Fernando Wood, wanted to secede from the Union so as to not join the Confederacy, but stay neutral in the war. So it's an ancient idea that if your proposal, you know, came to fruition, would make all of that make a lot of sense. Did you mention the idea, I'm curious, to any of the mayoral hopefuls who I imagine, you know, tramped through the nation's office en route to, they hope, the nomination?
I raised it hopefully to both Mondami and Lander when they were in the office, and I'm afraid neither of them rose to the occasion, but yeah. You know, We'll see how they feel once they get their budget frustrated but from Albany.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I first started thinking about disunion and secession in 2014, 2015, it seemed like a kind of cockamamie idea. Nobody was really with me. Obama was the president still. Now I see Gavin Newsom threatening to withhold tax payments to the federal government, you know, and it's kind of like, okay.
Well, and actually Lander, when he came into the office, he said that they had already researched what New York City could withhold from Albany and from the federal government as part of a task force to kind of Trump-proof, you know, New York City social programs. So I think people are thinking about it. I think it would be easier if New York City was its own state. But I also think that, you know, it's like when Obama was president, you saw secession movements on the right. When Trump was president the first time, for example, in Vermont, the other state that I have in longstanding ties to, once Biden got elected, the secession movement petered out. And it didn't really have much traction under Obama, but the first Trump term saw a lot of it coming out into the open and people considering the idea. You saw a lot of Vermont secession flags suddenly after 2016. And I'm assuming that they're coming out again. But I think in a way, if not serious, because I think this is a serious matter, a more immediately pertinent question is this question of what do we do when the country we belong to is occupying us? You know, that's what's happening in California now. I mean, right now, the governor is saying, we don't want the Marines here. The mayor of Los Angeles is saying, we don't want federal troops in our city, but the federal government is sending them into the city. And this is what the Compromise of 1876 essentially was supposed to settle, which is that the South got federal troops out. You know, that was the end of Reconstruction. The South got federal troops out to allow them to impose Jim Crow. And the federal government has been very hesitant to send in troops ever since. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower famously sent in paratroopers to enforce integration in Little Rock, and that was a very big deal. And he did it in defiance of the governor. Johnson sent in troops for the same reason, because there was whites were rioting in the South, and he felt that the government of Georgia was and Mississippi were not restoring order. But since then, it's only been at the request of the governor. When last time federal troops went into California was after the Rodney King riots, and that was because Pete Wilson, the Republican governor, and Tom Bradley, the Democratic mayor, both requested the National Guard to come in. So I think what's odd about what's happening as we're recording this week in the context of this long history is the feeling that America is once again becoming an occupied country.
Absolutely. And not this time, not by the forces of good, by the forces trying to spread racial equality and enforce the Constitution. It's definitely a frightening time. I mean, I think a lot of the pieces, quite apart from the secession question, or even federalism, you know, a lot of the pieces, I think, are intended at least to make us, if not feel better, then at least kind of suggest some resources for what might be the beginnings of a renewal or some kind of new vision, you know, as I write in the introduction, you know, a new birth of liberty, not quite the one that Lincoln was talking about and that the nation's founders were endorsing in naming their magazine The Nation, but some kind of new form of liberation, you know, local projects of resistance and organizing and even, you know, something as simple as gardening or baking bread, like the example of the woman, Joanne Bilinget, who wrote for Delaware. There's all these kinds of examples scattered across the issue and across the country of people trying to think kind of from the ground up, what might we be able to do differently or better to try to start some new national project of emancipation.
Well, and also not just emancipation, but learning to live with each other. I mean, I think for me, that's the most hopeful, even though we offered writers the choice of writing on the theme of union or disunion, and an awful lot of them picked disunion. But, you know, then there are plenty of them who also picked the kind of, we are so bound up with each other that we have no choice but to learn to live together. And we have to find a way to do that again, despite the increasingly polarizing influence of social media, you know, the news media. I'm thinking about Anna Clark's piece about water in Michigan, you know, which is a really wonderful reflection on the fact that we all have to drink from the same stream.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have to look after, we have to share water and we have to look after our water together, you know. And then there is that great piece in Delaware, but there's, you know, and then there's Makani Themba's piece from Mississippi about how you've got no choice but to keep fighting.
Right, and that's kind of like the Sarah Jaffe piece in Louisiana also, where there's more to the state than you think that there is. That the little number that we attach to the outline of the state saying, you know, who won the presidential election and by how much, only tells part of the story. You know, there's still people in Mississippi, though it's a deeply red state, fighting to make it better, as there always have been. And I also love the John Jeremiah Sullivan piece for North Carolina, where he's, you know, wrestling with this uncertainty and this discomfort, really, of being really turned off and repelled and kind of abhorred, seeing his neighbor's political views as truly abhorrent, but he also wants to be able to kind of see them as fellow people and really, really fellow Americans and continue to have kind of normal neighborly relations with them, as I do with the guy with the Samuel Alito flag down the street. And there's, you know, a bunch, I think some of my favorite pieces are not really landing one way or the other of talking about union or disunion, but it's really both and trying to kind of wrestle and live with that ambiguity.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, on the theory that a picture's worth 1,000 words, the most concise evocation of that in the issue is Judy Chicago writing, you know, not writing, sending us a piece of art, which I'm not going to try to describe, but it's spectacular and readers should seek it out.
Yeah, almost poster worthy.
Yeah, from New Mexico. I think it's kind of great. But I think, you know, there is the sense that we need a national renewal and there are some paths that writers stake out. I think part of what astonished me was that we managed, and by we, I mean you, since you did most of the work on this part, find writers in every state. I remember when we started, you know, it was like, well, who are we going to get from North Dakota? And we found, you found a writer from North Dakota. So who are we going to get from Nebraska? And, you know, we found great writers from these places. So
yeah, the Nation staff editors helped considerably in reaching out to people who they had edited and friends and friends of friends. Yeah, no, I'm very, very pleased with the issue. I think we got a really great amount of content. David Troyer, Indigenous historian writing for Minnesota. Julian Brave Noisecat writing for California, two great pieces. I think that's, you know, one source we could look to for renewal is, you know, the people who originally inhabited this continent and learned to live on this land. And there's some great pieces there. Also, Tom Kizia for Alaska with a timely warning for the people of Greenland not to accept the deal that Trump is offering them, because becoming America's most recent resource colony hasn't worked out that well for the people of Alaska. Yeah, there's just some really, really marvelous pieces, some by writers who have written for The Nation before, and some by people who we kind of looped in for the first time here.
Yeah, no, I was pleased to get a chance to get in three writers I've long admired and wanted to get into the magazine. Michael Clune, who's writing from Ohio, and Madison Bell, the novelist, whose work I've been reading for 30 years. And and Nell Painter, who sent us not just words, but art. So yep. Kind of great. All right. Well, I have really loved working on this with you, Richard, and I think there's a lot in it that our readers will and listeners will enjoy. So thanks so much for coming to the Nation podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Don, and congratulations on a very successful tenure as editor. You should feel very good about it.